Good morning. Thank you for joining me at this rather obscene hour. I'm really glad to see so many people are interested in this topic. Since SQL CLR was first introduced back in SQL Server 2005, I've been rather obsessed with it. And I will admit a certain degree of kind of hammer looking for a nail syndrome. I tried to apply it to many, many different situations. Some worked, many different didn't work. Over time, I realized that, at least for the kinds of work that I do, SQL CLR is a fantastic performance tool above all else. So today, this is a 400-level talk. This is one of the most complex talks I've actually ever written. And we're going to jump right in. I'm going to assume that all of you have at least played with SQL CLR a little bit, know what it is, know what it does. I'm not going to have any fluff up front. What we're going to focus on, we're going to jump right in. And we're going to focus on making our long-running queries faster, our largest, most analytical queries, our queries especially that do intra-row analysis, so queries that need to take a group of rows and do some analysis over those rows and then spit out some interesting result. And we're going to try to engineer solutions that are reasonably simple. When you're dealing with SQL CLR, there's never such a thing as really simple, but reasonably simple. And as reliable as we can get them. And that's our goal today. A little bit about me. I hail from Boston. I work in the financial services industry. And the people I work with in that industry are the kinds of people you would expect to meet in the financial services industry. Very impatient people, which is why I've become a bit of a performance specialist. Hopefully you've read some of my books. I've spoken at a lot of events over the past several years. This is actually the sixth time I've spoken to TechEd, and this is my third time speaking on SQL CLR. I spoke first in 2006 on CLR, then in 2010, and now. So they have me on a 3 or 4 year plan, and I'll see you in maybe 2017 on this topic again. You will want to make note of my website, sqlblog.com, where I will be posting all of the demos and all the materials sometime later this afternoon, most likely. Finally, my email address at the bottom of the screen, if you want to chat. I always love exchanging emails with people who are interested in technical topics or just otherwise. Finally, very quick pitch. If you like the kinds of problems I'm discussing in this talk, and you either live in the Boston area or want to live in the Boston area, and you're interested in a career opportunity, please drop me a line or come chat. I have a fantastic opportunity available for a really good database developer. All right? So here's how we're going to spend the rest of our time together today. First, we're going to jump right in, and we're going to talk about things that can go wrong when you don't kind of do SQL CLR the right way. The reason we're going to talk about that right up front at first is that keeping these things in mind helps us design correct solutions. Next, we're going to talk about various methodologies for getting data into and out of SQL CLR, and we'll finish up with an in-depth case study on a problem called the overlapping intervals problem. I'll get to that in just a bit. So let's begin. Here are the areas we're going to discuss: long-running threads, large memory allocations, and instability of your app domain. All of these things can cause problems. Well, all of these things can cause, especially the final problem, app domain instability. So long-running threads, first of all. Do you have processes that are high latency, or do you have logic that's time consuming? Now, I wrote on the Channel 9 website, and I asked whether anyone was looking for certain things in this talk. And a few people wrote back, and they said they were interested in web services, in using SQL CLR for web services. Well, this talk isn't about using SQL CLR for web services, but web services are a great example of a high latency operation, which means you make your web service request. It might take a second, might take 10 seconds. You don't have control over that time, and that thread is sitting there running. And maybe that's not a good thing. Likewise, if you have a lot of data that you're processing, a lot of number crunching that you're doing, that could be running for a long time. And if you don't take control of that, you can cause some problems. Now, to illustrate why this can cause some problems, let's dive in and take a little look at some thread scheduling internals. Now, SQL Server has this thing called SQL Operating System, SQL OS, which handles all of the CPU scheduling, and it has objects called schedulers. And a scheduler is basically an abstraction over a logical processor. All right? Now, it works very differently than Windows, in that the scheduler has these things called workers. And workers are an abstraction over a Windows thread. But the difference in SQL Server versus Windows is that a SQL Server worker is bound permanently to the scheduler which first spawned it. It cannot move around as they can in Windows. And when the worker is running, and there can be multiple workers on the scheduler, there's always one worker that's running. When the worker exceeds its quantum, and it's a 4-millisecond quantum, what happens is a cooperative process. The worker takes itself off of the scheduler, figures out whether there's any other workers that are waiting to do work on the scheduler, and then gives control to those workers. And then when this worker exceeds its 4-millisecond quantum, it's going to do the same thing, and it's going to give control back to the first worker. Now, what happens if you write some code in SQL CLR? And how many of you have written code in SQL CLR that knows how to take itself off of the scheduler and do all that stuff? Well, none of us, actually. We can get close. We'll get to that in a second. But most people don't even bother doing any kind of control at all. And as a result, what happens is that your thread becomes non-cooperative. And now, when the 4 milliseconds are exceeded, your thread doesn't get off the scheduler. Well, that's a bad thing. Eventually, 10 seconds later, SQL OS comes along and says, you're not being cooperative. I'm going to kick you off the scheduler. And it does this thing called quantum punishment, where it actually kicks the worker off the scheduler and penalizes it. And now your process slows down. And finally, after 10 seconds, the other worker that has been waiting this whole time gets to run. Meanwhile, you've been impacting the reliability of other threads on the system outside the scope of your CLR code. So we need to be able to control this. There's two options for controlling this. Option one, we need to teach our code to become cooperative. The way we do this is we add yield points. If there are places like in a loop as you're processing code that you can check and see whether you've been running for a long time, you can yield out using a sleep, just sleep for 0 milliseconds. That's a yield. That will cause your worker, your thread, to come off the scheduler. It'll cause SQL Server to exercise that check. It'll do that work on your behalf, and everything will work the way it's supposed to. The other way we can do this is we can tell SQL Server, look, I don't want to deal with implementing yields in my code. I want you, SQL Server, to just give the thread to Windows. Windows is very, very good at thread scheduling. It has a really, really good scheduling mechanism. And so we can tell SQL Server, give my thread to Windows by using the thread affinity API. It's on the thread object, and it's begin thread affinity to begin a section that will go out and be processed by Windows or handled by Windows, and end thread affinity at the end of that section. And you'll see in a few moments what that looks like when we go out to a demo. Problem number two, memory overallocations. We always need to remember when we're on SQL Server that memory is very, very expensive. Well, the memory chip is not any more expensive, but SQL Server is really expensive. So anything that we're doing with memory on SQL Server becomes more expensive. Now, in SQL CLR, this becomes an especially interesting issue due to the fact that the system.collections namespace, so system.collections, system.collections.generic, can very, very quickly allocate a lot of RAM. The reason for this is that once you exceed the size, the capacity of a given collection, it will double itself internally. And if you do math, 2 times 2 times 2 times 2 times 2, it very, very quickly gets very, very large, and you can use lots and lots of RAM. Now, to exacerbate this problem is the fact that a lot of developers aren't too careful about cleaning up their memory. Most of the .NET developers I know don't think about this stuff. And honestly, they don't need to, because on the application tier, memory is cheap. Resources are cheap. If we're working in an enterprise SQL Server instance, memory becomes 10, 20, 30 times more expensive just due to the licensing costs and due to the importance of our database and the fact that we want to keep everything running as quickly as possible. So we need to be especially wary of this. Adding to this problem is something called the large object heap. And let me give you a quick overview of what the large object heap is and why it's an issue. On the CLR side, there's two main memory regions. There's a stack. This is where all your value types go, your integers, your bytes, your booleans, all of your value types. So there's structs that you can have, or you can have classes. So if you have the struct, that's a value type that goes on the stack. If you have a class, that goes on the heap. The heap has this thing called garbage collection that occurs, and there's three generations, gen 0, 1, and 2. But there is a fourth area. It's called the large object heap. Anything over 85,000 bytes automatically goes on the large object heap. That means a collection over around with more than around 10,000 objects will automatically go on the large object heap. Now, the large object heap is actually collected even less frequently than Gen 2, so it doesn't get swept very often. And the idea is that if you're going to allocate a big class, you probably want to keep it around for a little while, or a big object, sorry. You probably want to keep it around for a while. But the issue is that over time, the large object heap tends to become fragmented. The GC has to sweep more and more often because it's this big, huge memory space putting pressure on other memory spaces. And so what I've seen in real systems where too many objects are going on the large object heap is overall performance starts draining as the GC spends more and more and more time trying to clean up and trying to get enough memory. Eventually, if this gets really extreme, SQL OS will detect a memory leak, or what it thinks might be a memory leak, and just go ahead and recycle your app domain. We do not want that to happen. So, how do we make memory kind of a non-issue? First of all, in .NET 4.0, which is now available in SQL Server 2012, there's a namespace called system.collections.concurrent. Now, these are designed to be collections that are used by multiple threads simultaneously, but even if you're only on one thread, they're still very interesting because these collections tend to have much lower memory footprints than the generic collections in the system.collections.generic namespace. Furthermore, these collections are mostly designed to not use the lob area at all. They internally, actually, for instance, the queue has a linked list of arrays, and each of the arrays is smaller than 10,000 objects, so it never hits the lob area at all. So these are really, really useful things to work with. Another thing, do your work in smaller batches if possible. If you're processing 50 million rows, perhaps you can pre-process in smaller batches and then put the results together or something like that, rather than bringing all of those rows into the CLR space, running a huge process, and then spitting out. Make sure you clean up even more than you would in a typical app, and favor streaming algorithms. That is to say, algorithms that return rows as soon as they're available, return results as soon as they're available, over algorithms that block and process the entire set and then only return the thing at the end. Now, the final issue that we might face is app domain, well, I should say instability, lack of app domain stability. So once again, our CLR runtime is controlled completely by SQL OS, and SQL OS can and will recycle your app domain if it detects what it considers to be an issue. Now, there's a number of different issues that can cause an app domain recycle to occur, but the two most common ones that I see in real production systems are orphaned locks and memory protection. So orphaned lock occurs if one of your processes, one of your CLR modules is inside of a lock, and it gets killed, an exception occurs, something happens. What the hosting runtime will often do is this thing called a rude abort, where it'll just kill your thread outright. Now, there's no chance for your thread to clean up its lock, so the hosting runtime detects there's an orphaned open lock, and it recycles the app domain out from under you. Not a good situation, so we want to be very careful about using locks. The other situation that can occur is if you're allocating too much memory too quickly, so using these collections, for example, can do that. The runtime will once again say, oh, this looks like a memory leak. Let's just recycle the app domain to be on the safe side. Now, usually, or I should say sometimes, if the app domain gets recycled, your requests simply get routed to a new app domain. But if you're referencing some memory in the old app domain, now you're going to get an exception. So a lock held by one process can cause an exception to occur on a completely different and unrelated process. Not a good situation to be in, so we want to be very, very careful there. All of this is exacerbated by these things called attention events. You know that 30-second timeout in ADO.NET? And you know that stop button in Management Studio? Those are the same thing under the covers. What those do is raise an event on the SQL Server side. It's called an attention, and it tells SQL Server, the client no longer cares. I'm going away. Clean up for me, please. When SQL Server gets an attention event, its job is to clean up and get everything back the way it should be. If you have something running in the CLR space, that's when one of these rude aborts takes place. It does not give your thread a chance to clean itself up. It just kills you, and you move on. So you need to be very, very careful with that situation. Now let's jump out to a demo. So what I've done here is I've written a query against the few of the DMVs, sysdm CLR tasks. This DMV has one row per thread that's currently running in the CLR space. Sysdm OS tasks. This DMV has information on the programs, the tasks that are being run by various sessions on your system. This is the bridge between a session and a thread. And the workers DMV, and again, the workers are logical abstractions over an operating system thread. Now, when I run this, nothing's running right now on my laptop. When I run this, we see that there's two threads by default created in the CLR space. I have my finalizer thread, and then I have this app domain unload thread, which controls recycling of the app domain. And there's a few columns we're going to look at. There's a session ID. Neither of these are running on a session, so they don't have one. There's a forced yield count. This is what occurs when that quantum punishment kicks in. And then there's information on preemption. Finally, we can see which schedulers these threads are bound to. Again, every thread in SQL Server is bound to a scheduler for its entire lifetime. So if we have multiple threads bound to the same scheduler, and they're each not yielding with each other, that means that they're each slowing each other down quite a bit. Now, what I'm going to do is I'm going to kick off this stored procedure that I've written. What this stored procedure does is it counts from 0 to about 4.2 billion, which takes around 20 seconds. On my laptop here. It's called spin for 20 seconds, no yield. And I'm going to open a new window. And I'm going to run it. OK, so it's running now. And let's ask the DMV what's running. So we see here's my process. It's running along. And after around 10 seconds, SQL Server has forced it to yield. And let's see if we can catch the second one before it finishes in about 20 seconds. Oh, there it is. And then it finished over here. So it didn't actually return anything or do much. It just used up a bunch of CPU time on us. And you saw, hopefully, that my DMV query is running pretty quickly. This query doesn't have to do very much work to run. So let's see what happens. Now, I have four schedulers. I have four schedulers, 0, 1, 2, and 3, which are visible online. That means they're available for user queries. I have four of them. And I'm going to open this program called SQL Query Stress. This is a load tool that I wrote. It's going to be included with the download as well. And what SQL Query Stress will do is it'll run whatever SQL you give it as many times as you want on as many threads as you want. So here I'm telling it to run my spin for 20 seconds no yield stored procedure. We'll run the other two in just a moment. I'm going to run it one time each on four threads. So we're going to fill up all the schedulers that we have and run this thing that's going to consume 20 seconds of CPU time per scheduler. Now, pretend like this is your web service call and that you just had four people call into it. I'm going to hit go. And let's go back to my DMV query. And when I run it right away, look how long it's taking. This query is not doing any more work than it was before. It just literally doesn't have time to run. It can't get on the scheduler. It can't get CPU time because my processes are not following the rules. They're not being cooperative. And you can see SQL Server has started to punish my processes, and that's what it'll do. But I've basically impacted reliability of my entire system by having these processes run. That's not a good thing. We need to get out of that business. So, as I said, we have two options for doing this. Option number one, here's another stored procedure I wrote. It's called spin for 20 seconds and yield. And what this does is it counts from 0 to 320 in this outer loop, and then it counts from 0 to this number in the inner loop. This number is 4.2 billion divided by 320. So I've just broken up the work into 320 pieces. And every time through this outer loop, we're going to go ahead and yield. Now, this is kind of a simple example of how you would do this. In reality, you would probably need some kind of timer or date time or something like that, and you'd want to check and see when you need to yield. Now, notice I'm not yielding every 4 milliseconds. I'm only yielding once every 1/16th of a second. Now, I decided maybe that's enough for my idea of what I need to be reliable. If you really want to play by the rules, you should try to stick as close to 4 milliseconds as possible, but maybe you don't want to stick that close depending on your requirements, and maybe you want to give your CLR tasks a little bit more time to finish. And I think that's okay, but I'll leave that decision, you know. It's not advice, that's just opinion. So that's my yield one. Now, a simpler way to do this is, again, to just give it to Windows. So this one, spin for 20 seconds preemptive, this has the same algorithm as before, count from 0 to 4.2 billion, but I've wrapped it in an affinity area. So as soon as the thread calls the begin thread affinity API, it goes preemptive. It's no longer being cooperatively scheduled. It's now under Windows control. And at the end, you have to call end thread affinity, or else you'll get an exception when the stored procedure returns. So let's go ahead and run each of these. I'm going to start with the yield one. I'm going to hit go, go back to my query here. And you can see that I have my processes running and my DMV query is returning really quickly. The reason is these things are yielding in and out. There's no forced yield that needs to take place. Everything's just good and operating the way it's supposed to be. These are acting just like SQL Server threads are supposed to act, and all is happy and good in the world. Now, another way I could do this, if I'm either, you know, it might be difficult to put in good yield points. And this is why I like to kind of just set things preemptive. I just write my algorithms the way I need to write my algorithms and let them go and let Windows handle it. So that's my preemptive one. This has the same basic effect, which is to say everything runs quickly. And we can see in the DMV that these threads are preemptive. They're just being handled by Windows. And they'll run in whatever the Windows quantum happens to be. The Windows quantum depends on your operating system version and your hardware and some other things. So anyway, either one of these solutions will work. You just kind of need to decide what's right for you and for your applications. And you need to make sure that if you have long-running threads and a lot of complex logic, that you choose one of these options. So the failure is to not choose and not do either of these. That's when you get yourself into trouble. And unfortunately, I have learned that the hard way. I've crashed a server from time to time. I'm not too proud to admit. But don't do that. All right? Anything I can clarify on either of those things? Over there? The question is, why wouldn't you just run everything preemptive? And the answer is, A, I do run most things preemptive. And B, some things you don't need to run preemptively. If you have processes that go in and out of logic very quickly and return results, every time that a result gets returned to SQL Server, like from a stored procedure or a table valued function, for example, a SQL Server will automatically internally do its own check because it takes back control briefly from your CLR thread. So if you have processes like that, you don't need to worry about this stuff. You do need to worry about this stuff. You have long-running threads that are sitting in the CLR space, not interacting back and forth with SQL Server for long periods of time. For example, high-latency web service calls. Make sense? Or, you know, database calls to external databases, things like that. Yes? The question is, how does the preemptive thread react to an attention event? The answer is the same way as any other thread. And actually, let's take a look at an attention event. Good question. So I've written this other thing. I wrote this table value function called getNumbers. Guess what it does? It gets numbers. You pass in a starting number and an ending number. It counts between the starting number and the ending number, and it returns whatever the number is, so it gives us a table of numbers. I've written this other store procedure. It's called enterMonitorAndSleep. It creates a new object. It takes a lock on that object, and it goes to sleep for 30 seconds. Now, as you can see, this object is local to this method. And the numbers generator has no idea what this object is, no idea that this lock is going to get taken. There's no interaction between these two things, except they are in the same app domain. They're in the same assembly. Well, let's go out to Management Studio. And I'll close that down. I'm going to grab this and throw it into a new window. And I'm going to ask for all the numbers between 1 and 10 million. That's going to take a decent amount of time to return. That starts going. I'm going to go over here, and I'm going to enter my monitor. I now have my monitor entered, and I'm asleep. I'm just going to hit stop. My query is canceled. And look what happened over here. Ouch. Moral of the story? There's a reason that locks are in the unsafe mode. You can use them, but you run a risk of getting an exception. If you need to use a lock, be very, very, very cautious with it. Make sure it's going to be very quick to reduce the possibility that one of these root aborts is going to kick in and orphan your lock. Make sure that your application, if it's talking to CLR code that uses locks, has some kind of retry logic or something else, so that if one of these framework abortions occurs, your application can just resubmit the query and try again. CLR can be very, very, very stable, but if you start doing really advanced things, you can run into some problems where you kind of make it less stable than it has to be. That answer your question there? Okay, so the question is, with extended stored procedures, we had this issue where they could become orphaned or disconnected from SQL Server's control, and it was impossible to kill them. I have not seen that with SQL CLR. That problem seems to be gone. SQL CLR is very, very tightly integrated with SQL Server's scheduler, much more so than extended events. And so it really does keep control pretty well. Is there anything else I can clarify on these things before we continue? Yes. Am I saying not to use locks? I'm saying to be very cautious with your locks and avoid them if possible. There's this whole school of thought right now around lock-free programming. This might be a good time to kind of start studying that, if possible, and learning how to interact. There's a namespace called system.threading.interlocked. And if you use that, it doesn't use locks, and you can still do kind of thread-safe operations without locks. And not run into this problem. It's when you kind of have monitors and it's being held for a little while and you get a thread abort that this will occur. So. So he uses a lot of sync routes on collections. Is there a way to make that code better? Well, I would evaluate, again, system.collections.concurrent. Where you don't need to use a sync route at all. They're just concurrent by nature. And most of those collections are non-locking. Unfortunately, the dictionary does use locks. So you do need to be careful with that one. But like the queue and the list, I believe, are lock-free. So you don't have to worry about those quite as much. So but unfortunately, there's no easy solution here. Again, it's a trade-off, though. If you don't mind a little bit of potential for instability, then maybe it's OK. It's just whether or not your application. No, really. I know it sounds like crazy. I'm going to introduce instability, but not all applications need to be like 100% stable all the time. Applications can have retries and things like that. It's okay. As a matter of fact, as we go to the cloud, I think we need to learn to write our code to be able to recover more easily in the event of instability, in the event of a disconnection, for example. Or something like that. So I think this is a good exercise for us. But I know it sounds insane. Maybe it is. any other questions at this point? OK. So let's take what we've just seen. And let's apply it. And let's look at some methodologies for getting data in and out of CLR on kind of a table-valued basis. So before we talk about CLR itself, we do need a baseline. And our baseline, of course, will be a T-SQL query. That's obviously the simplest way of getting data in and out of our database. Our application calls a query. The query takes the data off the disk or whatever, passes it back. Well, this has some advantages. This is obviously the most simple SQL Server construct. Pretty much all developers can write at least a basic SQL query, maybe not a really great one, but a basic one. And there's no what I call a data movement or data transfer cost associated with this, which is to say the data has to come off of disk and it has to go into memory, but it doesn't have to go into many memory locations along the way. It goes into the buffer cache, and then it kind of comes out of there. Maybe it goes into a sort or a hash table or something like that along the way, but that's all kind of just baked in to the process. There's no additional layers that we're adding to the situation. Now, the pure T-SQL query also has some drawbacks. I'm sure that we've all seen those 500-line or 1,000-line huge monstrosity T-SQL queries that were impossible to read because someone packed so much logic into them. T-SQL can get really, really, really complex. People have criticized it for being not very expressive, and it can be really difficult to write complex logic in T-SQL. A lot of people find it easier to write complex logic in C# or VB.NET or whatever. Performance can be really, really difficult to control in T-SQL. You're kind of at the mercy of the query optimizer, and maybe it'll decide to give you a good plan, maybe it won't. If you write your code in C# or something like that, if you get good performance, that's your fault. If you get bad performance, that's your fault. But at the end of the day, it's your fault. You're under control, and you can maybe make it better yourself without worrying about this third-party component. I'd say that's maybe a benefit. So if we want to move over from T-SQL to SQL CLR, most books on the topic will start with an example like this one, where the application calls into a stored procedure or user-defined function. The user-defined function uses the context connection, goes back, opens an ADO.NET connection, calls a query, pulls the data out of the database, passes it through the CLR logic, and then returns it out. Now, this maybe is faster than your pure T-SQL if you have a good use case. Obviously, you always need a good use case. The integration is very, very easy. The development is very simple. You usually just write a little query, pass it through some C# code, and you're off. It also, of course, has some drawbacks. We're adding additional layers. We're moving data from one place to another in memory. We're actually moving it from the buffer cache into the CLR memory space, then back out of the CLR memory space. So we're adding a significant amount of data transition overhead. Our logic in our C# program or our VB.NET program had better be good enough that it will be faster to process that logic in C# after moving the data in than it is to just process it in T-SQL. We add the additional complexity of assembly management, and the biggest problem for me with this model is that it is inherently single-threaded. The context connection can only run on one thread at one time. That means that if you go from, let's say, 1 million rows to 10 million rows, your code is going to become 10 times slower, and there's no way you can scale it up with this model. That, for me, was a big problem when I was playing with SQL CLR. So about 5 years ago, I started messing around, and I thought, what if my application calls my stored procedure, and I plug a threading library in there? And what if I teach that threading library how to go out and talk to ADO.NET and run a select, and then I could have it go out and talk to ADO.NET on a second thread, or a third thread, or as many threads as I want, and now I can scale the thing up. Now, instead of using the context connection, I have to use a loopback connection, basically just an ADO.NET connection back to the same database I'm in. So I'm adding quite a bit of additional complexity here and breaking a lot of the rules that we're supposed to follow with SQL CLR, but I can get really great performance, and I can scale up to as many CPUs as my server has available. Pretty nice. Unfortunately, I've added an extreme amount of complexity, and this feels really, really dirty. Suffice it to say, I think I broke every single unsafe rule. I'm using threading, I'm using synchronization, I'm using all this stuff. I wrote this pre.NET 4. So I had to handle all the threading myself, and things got hairy at various points in time. But I did use this on several projects, and it actually worked reasonably well. Well, I started thinking, how can I make this better? And so I sat back at some point, and I said, what are my actual goals here? My actual goal is to read some data in, analyze that data, I want to return a table-valued result, and I want scale, I want parallelism, so I can make things really, really fast. And I had a bit of an epiphany. I realized that we had a CLR module already that does most of that stuff for us right out of the box with no unsafe code at all, and it is the user-defined aggregate. By definition, an aggregate reads data in, reads it a group at a time, actually, so it's really good from a memory perspective because we can process our data a group at a time. By definition, an aggregate does analysis. By definition, an aggregate is plugged into the query processor, so it can exploit parallelism without us really doing much. Unfortunately, by definition, an aggregate does not return a table. It returns a scalar. Well, this was a bit of a problem, but then I realized I can call an aggregate, have it do some work, have it produce a table of results, and then I could pass that off to a CLR table valued function, which will actually spit out the table for me and return it back to my application. So once I set this up, it works pretty well. I have query processor integration, which means all of the iterators that I'm creating operate just like T-SQL iterators. They might block for a few moments and then return. They're parallelizable. My assemblies are completely safe. I don't need any kind of brute force. I don't have to add an extreme amount of complexity. A couple drawbacks. There may be, depending on how you implement this thing, a higher overhead of data transfer, because now we are adding two layers to the situation. Our T-SQL becomes ever so slightly more complex when we need to write the code that calls the UDA and the TVF. And this solution can be slightly temperamental. Sometimes the query optimizer doesn't quite play ball and give us the plan that we need. Usually it does, though. So how does this actually work? How are we getting this data from the UDA to the TVF? Well, there's two options for this. Option number one is what I kind of started with. I call this the slow but trustworthy option. We create our table of results. We encode it in either binary or XML format, and then we pass that to the TVF. And so now what we're doing is taking a bunch of rows in from SQL Server, producing some kind of big, huge blob, and then passing that across to a new memory location. And that's where that data transfer overhead gets pretty high. This works. It's really, really safe, but it's really, really slow. Option two, much, much faster, but ever so slightly, maybe it's not dangerous, but maybe it's slightly scary. We hold the data in memory, call into the UDA, hold the data temporarily in memory, call into the TVF, grab it out of memory, return it. Now we have no additional data transfer between the UDA and the TVF, and our code can run really, really quickly. We just need to be careful and use the memory the right way. So here's what I've come up with. First of all, we need to store the data somewhere in a static collection. Maybe you could use a concurrent collection, or I'll show you one that I've implemented myself, which uses some lock-free methodologies. We need to put that somewhere. And then in our UDA, we need to generate either a GUID or an integer key to call into the collection. So we're going to store our results temporarily in a centralized static collection. We're going to key off of them. And then once we're inside of the TVF, we're going to grab the data out and pass it back. All we need to be aware of is this SQL Server feature called partial aggregation. This is a parallel plan feature where SQL Server takes all the results off of your table on whatever thread the results happen to be on, or the data happens to be on, aggregates it partially, kind of halfway, and then repartitions and re-aggregates. You'll see in a few moments what that actually looks like. It works really, really nicely for aggregates like sums and counts and averages and things like that, where you just add the results back up. But if you have a table of results in memory, that can get really, really significant, and we can crash the app domain if we put too much memory in there all at the same time. So we need to avoid this feature, and you'll see how to do that. So let's take all of these techniques and let's apply them to a case study. And there's a problem called the overlapping intervals problem, which we'll take a look at. When I was writing this talk, so basically I work in, again, the financial services industry, and I apply a lot of these techniques to very proprietary algorithms. So when I was writing this talk, I was kind of brainstorming, what am I going to show that's a little bit more generally applicable? And I realized that a lot of my algorithms quite often have to deal with overlapping intervals and date ranges. And so I kind of abstracted that out of the proprietary parts and put it all together. So here's the problem in a nutshell. We have a bunch of intervals. So intervals are data with a start date and an end date. Maybe they're users using an application. Maybe they're customers going to a store. In the example that we'll see, they're going to be people staying at hotels. So a bunch of people stay at the hotel each night. There's check-in dates, check-out dates. And so there's a bunch of intervals, and they all overlap. Now, logically, what we want to do is we want to count how many intervals are active at any given point. So what we need to do, logically, is we need to find the start and end point of every interval, and then we need to start counting. So we go to the first subinterval, and we say, okay, there's one interval active here. Then we go to the second subinterval, and we say, okay, there's three intervals active here. We go to the third, and there's two, and then one, and then one, and then two, and then we skip one, and then we have one active interval there. Now, logically, we put these things back together, and maybe we notice that the gap between those two middle ones is very slim, and this is called interval packing. Maybe we want to just ignore that gap. Maybe it's a timing issue. Maybe we just don't care if there's really, really small gaps. So we pack that together, create one seamless interval. So that's logically what we're going to do. And start thinking of how you might solve this in T-SQL. It's kind of an interesting problem. Let's jump out to Management Studio. So I created my database. It's called Hotel Sample. And it has a table called Hotels. And the hotels have names and addresses and cities and states and things like that. Then they have a number of rooms that are available each night. And then there's another table called Hotel Stays. And the hotel stay has a stay identifier, a hotel ID, a check-in date, and a check-out date. So let me just show you. There are 4,000 hotels. What I did was I actually did some research, and I found out that the biggest hotel chain in the world has about 4,000 hotels with about 600,000 rooms in total. I'd love to see the 600,000 room hotel. But so I put 4,000 hotels here, and then I populated the hotel stays table with information for the last 2 weeks' worth of stays, which is about 3.9 million rows in my database. And as you can see, each stay has a check-in date and a check-out date, and there's a bunch of overlap between these. So these are all one-night stays, these are some two-night stays, here's a three-night stay, and there's all kinds of variety in the database. So there's all kinds of overlapping and mixing and matching and things like that. And our goal is to count per hotel how many people stayed during each sub-interval with all the sub-intervals packed together as tightly as possible. And I started writing a solution for this in T-SQL, and very quickly I realized that there's like a million different ways to solve this problem in T-SQL. And if I'm going to show you a comparison between a T-SQL solution and a CLR solution, what if my T-SQL solution is terrible and really slow? Then I'm lying to you. I didn't want to lie, so I went out and I asked a good friend of mine, Itzik Ben-Gon. Hopefully you're familiar with his name. He's spoken at TechEd a bunch of times. He's probably the best T-SQL guy in the world. He's really interested in interval problems, as it turns out. And I asked Itzik to write me a query. He actually wrote me four different versions of the query. And this one, let me just jump in here. I'm going to include actual execution plan. This query that he sent me is the fastest of the queries he sent. Now, I mentioned before, one of the drawbacks or potential drawbacks of T-SQL is it can be very, very complex. And this query is, in fact, very complex. You can see it's doing all kinds of row numbers, lead, lag. It's an incredibly clever algorithm. I highly recommend studying it on your own time. Itzik is a brilliant, brilliant guy. But this is the query he sent me, and I'm going to go ahead and run it. It's really a clever algorithm, actually. I'll just quickly tell you. He grabs all of the check-ins and check-outs, and they're union-alled together, and then he gives the check-ins a plus one and the check-outs a minus one, and then at each point along the way, you just add up all the prior rows, plus ones and minus ones. Really clever algorithm. I mean, I don't know if a lot of T-SQL developers out there can come up with something that slick, at least easily. So pretty amazing. I'm going to go ahead and run it, and we'll just ask for information on hotels between 1 and 500. And you can see the results start streaming back. And what we got here takes about 7 seconds to run. Let's see. Well, okay, that's weird. So Management Studio is reporting 7 seconds, but SQL Server reported 5.6 seconds. So we'll trust SQL Server on that one. Maybe Management Studio was a little slow to render the data. If we go over to look at the execution plan, it's kind of a serial plan. Start with the hotels table, do a nested loop. So for each hotel, we go out and run this big, huge subtree with the stuff. All of this big stuff happens, and all the results are tabulated, and they come back, and we're happy. So what I wanted to figure out, first of all, and what I always want to figure out when I'm creating a SQL CLR solution, is whether it's a good idea to even start implementing the solution. And as I mentioned before, when we move to SQL CLR, there's a major data transfer overhead that we're adding. So the first thing we need to do, in my opinion, is figure out whether we can even get close if we put that data transfer overhead into the mix. So the first thing I write whenever I'm considering this is I write a stored procedure or function that just reads the data and doesn't do anything with it, just so I can figure out how long it's going to take me to get that data into the CLR space. So this stored procedure, read hotel stays, you pass it a min hotel ID and a max hotel ID. It uses the context connection. It grabs the data from the table in the correct order. And then it just loops and increments a row counter so that it can eventually return how many rows it saw. And when I go ahead and run this, I'm going to run it for 500 hotels. And it ran in about 3.4 seconds. Now, interestingly, if I run this again, it runs in only 1.8 seconds. That's a lesson to be learned there. The first time you run any CLR object, the just-in-time compiler kicks in, compiles it up to native binary, and then from there on, it just runs against that native version. So if you're testing, hopefully your app domain's not unloading itself so often that that JIT time becomes a real issue in your real application. So anytime you're testing performance, you really want to run the thing twice so that you can make sure you're getting that really optimized, really good version. So we ran this thing in 1.8 seconds. Now, its solution took, 5.6 seconds to run? So we have actually quite a bit of wiggle room. What I found is that if you're writing at least decent algorithms, maybe not the best algorithms in the world, but decent, the data transfer overhead, getting the data in and out of the CLR space, will take up the majority of the time. It turns out the algorithm, because C# is really, really good at processing algorithms, the algorithm is usually almost inconsequential. So let's apply the algorithm. Now, what I've written is a component called interval counter. And interval counter uses kind of a aggregation model. You initialize your interval counter. You accumulate rows into your interval counter. And you have to pass the rows into the interval counter in the correct order. And it goes ahead and verifies that as the rows get passed in. When you're done passing rows in, you terminate, and it gives you back a stream of results. Now, internally, I'm storing them in a queue. I know I told you to use concurrent queue, but I know that 10,000, even if every single day gets its own result, that's 10,000 days before I hit that lob space. That's a lot of years' worth of data. So I'm not really concerned in this case. So again, you want to use concurrent queue if it makes sense. You can use a normal queue if it makes sense. As long as you're thinking about it, that's really what matters here. So I have my little interval counter, and I can plug it in to my stored procedure. This is the same stored procedure as before. I'm reading the data in order. I set up the interval counter, and then for each row, check to see if it's the hotel that we were processing last time on the last iteration. If not, we terminate and return the data. And if it is, then we accumulate into the interval counter. And that's it. Let's go ahead and run it. So get hotel stay interval counts, 1 to 500. Not bad. We just dropped the query from 5.6 to 2.8 seconds by applying the logic in C# instead of T-SQL. Pretty good. You should be happy with this, maybe, until, there's always a catch, until you need to process 4,000 rows. Now we're going to process 8 times more data. Is ITSIC's query going to take 8 times longer? Let's find out. Well, ITSIC's query shouldn't take 8 times longer. It took longer than it should have, actually. I think it should have taken 12 seconds. But it took about 17 seconds to run. And notice it's consuming 49 seconds of CPU time. Well, that's because it's running now using a parallel plan. And we can see this because we have these little yellow parallelism icons. So it was able to use a bunch of threads on the server and take advantage and scale up so that it's not running 8 times slower anymore. Unfortunately, if I try to read all the stays, and I'm just going to read them, I'm not even going to run them through the logic, between 1 and 4,000, my code is not going to scale. Again, because it uses the context connection. So it's going to sit here and run and run and run, and it is going to take 8 times longer than before. It took 13 seconds to read the data. So we're kind of starting to eliminate our benefit of our C# code. And this is where my threading library comes into play. The threading library will be in the download. It's called the Query Parallelizer. And what it does is you give it a min hotel ID, a max hotel ID, and you give it the number of threads. And you create this object called Query Parallelizer. And you give it the type that you want it to return. The Query Parallelizer takes a query as its input, and the query includes a between predicate on whatever you want to process on. And you say, okay, I want to process all of the hotels between this number and this number, and I want you to do that work on this many threads, and I want you to pass the results as they come off the query through this enumerable. Now, what the query parallelizer does is it spins up as many threads as you ask for, and it splits the input range evenly across all those threads, and each thread gets its own subrange. And then the results are all merged back through a lock-free data structure and passed back to the caller so they can be streamed back to the application. So when I run this, and what I'm going to do is I'm going to do hotels between 1 and 4,000. I'm going to give it the number of threads that's set in my max degree of parallelism at the server level. So it's going to get the same number of threads that the T-SQL query got. And I'm going to call it. And now, not bad, 4,000 hotels processed in just about 3 seconds. So significantly faster. Unfortunately, as I said, I feel really dirty at this point in the game. I don't like myself. My server doesn't like me either, because I'm basically treating it like garbage. And so what I want to do is come up with maybe something a little bit more balanced, maybe a better approach. And so, again, I came up with this UDA idea. And what I've created, once again, is a version that reads the data. I want to see whether my data transfer overhead is decent or not. So I created a read-only interval aggregate. And I accumulate starts and ends. And all I do is increment a counter so that I can get back the data, figure out how many rows I read. And I'm going to go ahead and call that. I'll ask for data for hotels between 1 and 500. I want the basically number of rows I've read. It's effectively a row count at this point, grouped by hotel ID for all those hotels. And when I run that, I get back my data pretty quickly. It read all 500 rows in, returned my results in a mere 664 milliseconds. So I know I have a lot of wiggle room if I want to beat that T-SQL solution. So I'm looking pretty good. Now, our query plan. In this case, it's a very simple serial plan. The tricky part comes if we make it into a parallel plan. So if I go up to 4,000, the query processor is going to do the right thing for me, and it's going to automatically figure out, okay, you're processing more rows, maybe you can benefit from parallelism, And so there's all of my 4,000 hotels. It ran in 1.4 milliseconds and gave me a nice parallel plan. Unfortunately, it's not so nice because it has this partial aggregation thing. And this is what partial aggregation looks like. You have an aggregate, then you have a repartition, and then you have another aggregate. And what happened was that it effectively read the rows off of my hotel stays table in whatever order they happen to be in. Maybe there's a data page with the data for hotel number one, and data for hotel number two, and data for hotel number three. And then maybe another thread got a data page with data for hotel number one, and data for hotel number two, and data for hotel number three. Now, both of those threads went and aggregated up the results as well as they could on whatever thread the data happened to be on. But then to get the final result, we need all the data for hotel number one on the same thread, and all the data for hotel number two on the same thread, and so on. So SQL Server had to repartition the results, send data around between the threads, and then aggregate up again. Now, this works really well with something like a sum, where a partially aggregated sum can be added to another partially aggregated sum, and then you just get the right result. And a sum is very small. It's just an integer. But if we're actually holding a table of results in memory, and we need to hold it for a long time, that can be huge. We don't want to do that. We need to make sure we're processing our data in SQL CLR in a piecemeal fashion. So if we want to get around this, what we need to do is use the cross-apply operator. And what we do is start with the hotels table, and then we cross-apply into our logic. And what this does, and we correlate in here, so instead of just grabbing data straight from hotel stays, we grab from hotel stays where hotelstays.hotelid equals hotels.hotelid. And what this does is it comes up with a loop join plan. Let me show you what it looks like. So in our loop join plan, we grab the data from the hotels table, then go into this loop. And so for each thread will have some hotels. And each thread will start looping one hotel at a time and do the work. Now in here, and I'll show you what the query looks like in a second, we seek against the hotel stays table. The data gets passed to our UDAG just for whatever hotel we're in the loop for. Then the UDAG result gets passed to the values table valued function and gets output. Now let me show you what the T-SQL looks like, and then we'll look at the C# code and finally run it. So what the T-SQL looks like is we grab data from hotel stays, and we need the data to be ordered to be passed in to our user-defined function. It expects the data in the right order. And the way that I enforce this, now I know that it's going to work because I have an index in place, but what if I wasn't sure if that index was going to stay around and I didn't know if it was going to always read from the index in the right order and so on and so forth? So the way that I implement this is I force my user-defined function, interval_ag in this case, and to take as its input a row number from the outer query. So for each hotel, it's going to go to the hotel stays table, calculate a row number, and then pass that row number to my aggregate. Now the row number has to be calculated prior to the aggregate getting called, and SQL Server has no choice but to calculate that row number and to order the data correctly in order to calculate that row number properly. So the data, by definition, has to be ordered if I put the row number in there. So that's how I enforce that. Then we call the aggregate, and the aggregate in this case just returns an integer. Now, SQL Server doesn't know what this integer is. The integer, as it turns out, is always going to be zero. We know this, but SQL Server doesn't know this. So we return this integer, and the integer gets passed in to our table valued function, which is interval values, and interval values uses that integer to go out, grab the values from memory, and stream them back. Now on the C# side, let me show you what this looks like. Here's my aggregate. Now my aggregate internally has a collection of interval counters, and the collection is on a type called boundless array. Boundless array is something that I created, and it's a collection that's designed to look just like an array, but with no begin or end bounds. And it automatically populates only as many slots as you actually use in a sparse fashion, though. So you could have slot number one populated and slot number 2 billion populated. And instead of having 2 billion actual slots in memory, you only have actually about 1,000 slots in memory, because it does it on a little bit more granular basis, or a little bit less granular basis. So in this case, we have all these slots available. Now what we're going to put in them, we're going to key them off of the managed thread identifier. Now as long as we're sure that our data is being processed on the same thread every time, over and over as we call into the aggregate and later into the TVF, then we know that we're going to have the same managed thread ID. And since we're using that nested loops plan, each thread is going to call into the loop once per hotel, and it's going to keep calling into the loop over the course of the same thread and get the same managed thread ID. So we're always going to have our same data when we come into the C# or into the CLR code as we had last time, the same collections. So when we initialize, we create our new interval counter for this group. When we accumulate, we pass the rows to the counter, and we take the row number as input, but we don't use it. SQL Server doesn't know that we're not using it. SQL Server has no way of knowing. All SQL Server knows is that we've asked for it to be passed to the C# code. So it's forced to comply, and it orders the data appropriately, even though we don't actually do anything with it. And then when we terminate, we just return 0. We don't actually have to return anything, because the managed thread ID is the key, and it will be available when we come back on the same thread later. Now, the special thing we've done is merge. Merge is what's used in a UDA when partial aggregation occurs. I don't want partial aggregation ever, because that means I'm going to have one interval counter loaded per hotel. I might have up to 4,000 interval counters storing rows in memory simultaneously. I don't want to use all that memory. I want to make sure that people use the correct pattern to call this. So I've told merge to just throw an exception. If you get a bad query plan, merge will tell you, and you have to get a new query plan. That's kind of the price that we pay. So that's the aggregate. And once the aggregate gets called, we call into the values function. The values function takes our token. Once again, SQL Server doesn't know what we're going to do with this token. All it knows is that it has to process the aggregate, and then it has to pass the result of the aggregate to the table value function. It doesn't know whether we're going to use it or not, but it is forced that way to process the aggregate first, then call the table valued function. The table valued function simply grabs the results from our counter set. It terminates, and it returns the values one row at a time. End result. When I go ahead and run this, nice parallel query plan, completely safe and integrated code, 2.8 seconds, and only 18 seconds instead of, what was it, 57 seconds before? Only 18 seconds of CPU time consumed. So I'm pretty happy with that. anything I can clarify on everything that I just talked about? In the back? Good question. So the question is, was the data cached the first time? It actually wasn't, because I'd already run a select against it. It actually was cached the first time, so it shouldn't make a difference. But we'll run it again, I want to be perfectly fair. So the question was the data loaded into the buffer cache, and are my tests not fair to the SQL query? So, and it took 9 seconds that time, so maybe there was a caching issue. But check that out. 73 seconds of CPU time. So still, my CLR function, even if there are cache artifacts, is at least 3 times faster, elapsed, and way faster, or way lower overhead in terms of CPU time. So I'm still happy.
Just a quick question, optimization question. So the, I think it was the interval ag that's not used, but we're faking it out, passing it as an N32. Is there any reason not to send it as a bit, maybe?
The question is, the interval ag, we're returning an int32. Could we return a bit instead? Sure, if you want. I mean,
is it more optimized?
Is it more optimized? I seriously doubt you're going
to.
Right. I seriously doubt you're going to notice any difference there.
Okay.
So, but you know, give it a try. Let me know if it works out for you. So, yes, sir. Would caching of the execution plan have helped the T-SQL? Yeah, a little tiny bit. I mean, obviously, execution plan caching helps. And in this case, it's a fairly complex query plan. I don't think it probably only took a couple milliseconds to compile it, though. I don't think this is like a, I mean, I've seen some query plans that take like a minute to compile. This one is not one of them. So I don't think we have an issue here with that one. So. So the question was, I demonstrated using the TVA and TVF without using binary or XML return. Is there any case where I would want to use that? None that I can think of. This is, as long as you're calling this, again, on a granular basis and you're being careful to not get partial aggregation, I think you can safely use that memory. It gets a little scary because people worry that, you know, maybe the app domain will get unloaded out from under them and the memory will disappear. But as we saw, we're actually going to get an exception. So for me, personally, and again, this is a trade-off you need to make and a decision you need to make for yourself. For me personally, what I'm worried about is incorrect results being sent back to the application. I'm 10 times more worried about incorrect results than I am about an exception. If an exception occurs, we know the results are incorrect. If incorrect results come back and no exception occurs, then we can make bad business decisions. So for me, this is a fairly safe setup because I know that if something goes wrong, an exception is going to occur. I already demonstrated that. If the app domain gets unloaded, our query is going to fail, and the application will know that it has to retry and restart its process. For me, I'm not afraid of using memory in this way and using just a little bit of memory in a very granular fashion. If you are a little bit more wary of that kind of thing, then you could maybe test performance of the binary or XML methodology. Any more? Yes, sir. Yep, the question is, I've done a lot of work to avoid that stream aggregate. What can you do on the optimizer to avoid it? And again, the key is to use the apply operator. Where did my query go? So the key, again, is that we start here and we apply into the inner query. Now, the apply operator does not have to optimize to a nested loop, but we can do something to force it down that road, which is we can put a top right here. And you just put top in a big number, like 2 billion. Now, logically speaking, there's no way, at least no method I can think of outside of like quantum computing or something, to logically, for the query processor to count a top number of rows, regardless of what that number is, per hotel without going one by one through each hotel, coming in here, counting the top, and coming back. And we know there's going to be fewer than 2 billion rows, but once again, the query processor doesn't know that. It actually has to, if I run the query plan here, and the top's not needed in this case because we did get the right plan, but if I run the query plan here, it puts the top there. We know that there's no way there's going to be 2 billion rows there. The query processor does not know that. Our contract with the query processor is such that it absolutely has to verify that. So that's how you 100% make sure it's going to do that and give you the right behavior. So I wouldn't always use it. I mean, it doesn't really matter. It's a very cheap operation anyway, but it adds a tiny bit of overhead. Any other questions? What is my deployment strategy? I was hoping no one would ask that. So Microsoft, notice that I'm not using the newest version of Visual Studio. So Visual Studio 2010 includes CLR projects, which I'm a big fan of. And Microsoft dropped support for them and now has this thing for called SSDT. And SSDT doesn't really play that well with SQL CLR. So I'm still using 2010. And what I've done is I've gone in and I've modified the MS Build manifest file. So if you try to deploy to SQL Server 2012 from 2010, you'll get an exception saying that it's not supported, which is unfortunate. So what I've done is I've hacked the MS Build manifest file. And I can, if you want to find me at the MSE, whatever they call it, the Ask the Experts area later, I can show you how to do it. I hacked the thing and I removed the part that actually deploys the code to the database. And what that does, when I right-click and click deploy, deploy, it's not going to actually send anything. Oh, it failed anyway. Well, that's okay. Well, I'm not sure why it failed, but what it was supposed to do, and this code does build, so maybe I have it set up incorrectly. What it was supposed to do is do everything up to the part where it creates the script. Let's actually go to the folder here. Bin release. So it creates this script, and instead of running the script, it just creates it. So then I take that script, and I just run it myself, and then it works. So that's effectively my deployment strategy. And then let me see if I have it here. Once I have the script, I've written this stored procedure called script assembly. I don't know what scripts are in this database. And what script assembly does, so what I'll do is I'll deploy my script using the deployment script to dev server, and I'll get everything the way I want it. And unfortunately, there's some other issues where, like, for example, Visual Studio doesn't have good schema support, things like that. And sometimes I want to put my CLR modules in a given schema. So I'll set all that up myself, and then I'll run script assembly. And script assembly, when I run it, gives me this nice big script, and it gives me all of my assemblies and everything else. So I think I published this on my blog at some point. So you can go out and look for that. So anyway, that's how I do deployment, and that's how I do management. And I check this script into source control so that I can verify that I'm running the right things and everything else. So anything else I can clarify for anyone? All right. Looks like we're just a few minutes left anyway. So hopefully you've seen that CLR can make your big, heavy logic faster. You might have to play a couple games to make sure that you don't get in the way of SQL OS, to make sure that you don't harm the reliability of your server. As a developer, personally, I think it's really, really fun to discover and explore new ways of solving what seem like old and already solved problems. I hope that you'll agree. I really, really appreciate your joining me today. I enjoyed it a lot. And if you would be so kind as to fill out the evaluations, I read every single one of them, and I would love to know how you feel about this session. Thank you very, very much. SQLblog.com to grab the demos. They'll be posted probably, we'll say within 3 hours.